The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Welcome back to Millennial 2023 for the final stream of this, the 13th night. And it is with Antidem. Now, Antidem and I go way back to, I think, definitely 2015. I remember talking to him in early that year, but I think probably 2014, to the very first year of my channel. So, Antidem, you have appeared on Millennial several times. Welcome back.
You know, guys, I'm pretty convinced. Okay, first, are you sure that the title of the stream doesn't still say Radix Verum?
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah, well, don't worry about Odyssey. We'll update in a while.
All right. What was it? You know, guys, I'm pretty sure that Wozy brings me on as a way to cheer himself up, because every time we talk before I'm going to come on stream, and I'm like, well, I want to talk about this serious topic. I want to talk about that serious topic. He's like, no, for heaven's sakes, let's talk about something fun. Good heavens. So I think everybody else just depresses you.
No. It's not like that at all. I don't know how you've got that impression. It's more than I expect, because you've usually got this, you know, 1950s radio voice. So I kind of associate you with happy things and googie architecture and so forth, and 80s films, this kind of thing. So that's why. But I should have said to everyone first that Antidem has been a bit ill recently. Nothing serious, just the flu type thing. So that's why he doesn't sound all like quite his usual self. But nonetheless, he's going to entertain us for a while. Let's see. With that, scintillating conversation.
That and huge balls.
Well, of course.
No, seriously, I've already told Millennial was this back when it was happening during the summer. I actually had a medical condition and called a scrotal edema, where my balls inflated or swelled to about the size of a watermelon. And that happened for about 2 solid months. And it was about as unpleasant as it sounds. And I guess that's all part and parcel of having turned 50 this year, almost last year. So that put me in a great mood. that made things better.
You don't need to tell people this.
It's true. You know what, guys? I'm here to tell you, just be careful what you wish for, because, you know, having the biggest balls in the South was not as much fun as I thought it was going to be. Like, literally not being able to walk more than 10 feet. Yeah, that was great.
When you say a watermelon, that's an ambiguous. There are different sizes of watermelon. How big are we talking?
I would bet it would be about, if I put my hands on either side of them, about 1.5 feet.
Oh, God.
If you really want to see off air, I will send you a picture.
Well, thank you for the offer. Let's get to more cheery topics.
I mean, look, I'm sure it could be worse. I'm sure it could be cancer or some dread, thing like that happening like that. I'm so happy it wasn't. My sister died at 34 of breast cancer. At least that didn't happen to me. But yeah, that was Pumpkin Balls McGee. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. But yeah, I was basically Randy Marsh in that one episode of South Park for about 1.5 months. That was
God. It sounds awful.
By the way, it's not all the way back to normal now, but it's much better. Thanks for asking. So I can live a normal life at the moment. But yeah, that was they're getting older, folks. You know, when all of my elders told me don't get old, it sucks, I didn't believe them. But yeah, here we are. Well, you turned, 41 this year?
Soon, yeah, yeah. It's a strange thing, because I was 31 when I started the channel. So, yeah, it's going to be I don't know what to say. I have talked about this. Time just doesn't stop. It just doesn't stop. And so, yeah, you keep getting older. There's nothing you can do about it. And it seems to go faster as well. So a year was a bloody long time when I was a child.
Yeah.
And now it's not fucking much at all. And, you know, I've lived through 40 of them. So, yeah, it's odd. I think when I die, I'll still be baffled by this matter of time and how this doesn't stop.
How do we get to be old?
Sorry, you go.
Because, you know, I mean, frozen in my mind is this idea that, you know, all the Vietnam veterans are still 40, 50 years old, you know, and all the World War II veterans are still 70. And, you know, that whole thing just passed in the blink of an eye.
Well, exactly. And I think of Gen X as being in their 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And millennials being in their 20s and teens. But it's not the case anymore. It's really not. I guess the youngest millennials are still in their 20s. But, you know. I can bloody remember us being like 18 and just emerging into adulthood. At the time of the millennium, and it was the future and all that, and now there are the Zoomers and Gen Alpha. It happens. I guess it happens. I remember a guy saying to me once when I was 16, 17, he said that getting old happens to everyone, and the sooner it happens, the better. It shatters your illusions that you're going to be, you know, young and fit and healthy forever.
So, actually, you know, speaking of that, what's a really okay? First, I absolutely hate Danny Boyle. I hate his movies. I hate his attitude. I hate his politics. But Trainspotting 2 is a really good.
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it. I do love the song that was used in the trailer. It was by. It's called Silk, and it's by some, you know, modern British band called Wolf Alice. And the girls, fuck's sake, the lead singer is so sexy. But that's all I've seen of Trainspotting 2. Now, the first film I saw at the cinema at the time, even though it's ridiculous. I think we were only 12 or 13. When they were so lax in those days. So I saw it at the cinema, obviously saw it on video a few times after that, but I don't actually think I've ever, I don't think I've seen it this century. Trainspotting, and I definitely haven't seen the sequel. So why don't you tell us about your experiences of the first film, and then we'll segue quite naturally to the second film.
I don't have that much to say about it. I remember the first film I watched in the cinema, like you. We'd been in Ottawa somewhere in 1996. With a girl I was quite fond of. It's very raw. It's very darkly funny. And the second one, just sort of, you know,
there's more to say about that. Come on, you've got to talk about it's the Gen X, energetic 90s. Everyone was young. It's postmodern. It's sarcastic. It's very British and gritty. Working class, even though Ewan McGregor's not very middle class in the role because he can't do accents. And it was very clever at the time. The film was very, it was like nothing else.
You know what it reminds me of is there was a rumor going around a couple of years ago that they were going to do a remake of Daria, the MTV TV series. And
is that the sarcastic girl?
Yeah, the one that's spin off from Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, look, you can't do a woke reboot of Daria. Daria having any strong political opinions and not just being cynical and wanting you to go away is not Daria. Like, that whole Gen X cynicism, you know, I don't know. Maybe it just all melted away, like the cynicism of the lost generation after World War I. You know, who knows? But, or, you know, maybe it just melted on 9/11, or I don't know.
This is a thing, isn't it? That, well, the 9/11 and Gen X, maybe it did have an effect on them, but I don't think it got rid of their cynicism. I think that wokery, when it emerged in the early 2010s, that melted Gen X's cynicism, because it gave them a cause, something that they could believe in, even though it's retarded.
Yes, I think that's more a millennial thing, and I think Gen Z is steering away from it. I think if you look at Gen Z, certainly if you look at white male Gen Z, they are way more right-wing than any of their forebears for generations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a reason for that. But, you know, I guess what one of the things you're trying to say there is the original Trainspotting was very much a document of its time. It was very much, this is the mid-90s. And what T2 did was, you know, how much can you ever go home again? You know, can you, who are you when that era moves on and you're, you know, you're in a different place in life, the world's in a different place, you know, that's what I think it was looking at. And, you know, it's where I go a lot these days. You know, we're a few days away from the new year.
See, the thing is, you know, you won't be aware of this, but I actually get the same feeling when I go back to Edinburgh now. It's not the Edinburgh that I used to know.
Yeah.
So many buildings, so many fucking awful new buildings are there. And the whole atmosphere is different. And obviously the demographics rapidly changing compared to 20 years ago. So it really, you know, if T2 shows, see, T2 used to mean Terminator 2 Judgment Day. I don't know. Now we use it for Trainspotting too. If T2 shows these Scottish guys, middle age, and Scotland, Edinburgh has moved on and is now a different city, I can relate to that.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
I mean, you've got to remember, if you think about that first film where Begbie is kissing a girl and he reaches down and he realizes it's a tranny. And so he's angry with the tranny, and then he goes and presumably tells the story to the others, Sick Boy and Renton, and they make fun of him, if I recall correctly. But either way, there's where he brings out his knife and he says, "I'm not a buffty. I'm not a faggot. I'm not gay." You know, could you do that? I mean, I've not seen the sequel, but could you have a homophobic, transphobic Begbie? Or would he now? I mean, you tell me.
Well, part of the problem with sort of woke Hollywood is they can't make a good villain anymore. And speaking of Scotland and your fellow Scotsman, The Critical Drinker, man, that guy is tearing up the world.
Well, I'm not on YouTube anymore, so I don't see this stuff. I did watch a few of his videos when he was new, and I also watched them now and then, you know, since then. But it's not it's not my kind of thing. And Nerdrotic is another one. You know, I obviously share his exasperation with the state of science fiction. But to me, it's like, it's kind of like where I was 10 years ago politically, or 15 years ago.
Yeah, but, you know, you got to remember, all of us who are in this thing have to remember, we are way, way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, and I'm not holding them, like, I don't have contempt for Nerdrotic and these others for being behind us. I'm not holding it against them. I'm just saying there's not that much that I'm going to get from watching their stuff. That's all I mean.
Here's the thing, and I'm going to disagree with you here. I think these guys are very, very important. One of the problems that we seem to have in our thing is not being able to really tell the difference between a gatekeeper and a gateway drug. And I think a lot of times we get frustrated with people who we see as gatekeepers who are just gateway drugs. And, you know, you can see that in the progression of some of them. I mean, think of where Sargon was 5 years ago. And think of where he is now. You know, he's saying things now he would never have said back then.
Oh, yes. He's saying things now that he attacked me for saying back then. And others. So, yeah, he's definitely changed in that way, certainly.
And I think, you know, part of the thing is, this thing of ours is not very accessible on its own. It tends to live in a cloud of, you know, political theory and, you know, esoteric religion and 5,000-word Mencius Moldbug essays and all of that. And it's tough to get into that. So anyone who can bring people in the easy way, I think, is a big help. And I think there, one of the most important things to remember is the importance of fun. It's just the importance of, you know, not being serious all the time. And
very intensely political all the time. Yeah,
Intensely political, intensely online. You know, so, and this is especially true in a time where the left has turned into a bunch of starch-collared, vinegar-drinking scolds. And none of us, you know, none of us want to hang out with that. Nobody wants to be that. But you tune into Geeks and Gamers or Nerdrotic or any one of those, you know, Razor Fist and all that. They bring a real sense of fun to things. And I think that's very important. I think that's going to bring in a lot of people. I think to this day we underestimate how many people Gamergate brought in the door.
You might be right. Someone's actually just said in the live chat that he was brought into this whole thing by the Critical Drinker.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's interesting.
So I think one of the tragedies we've seen, and yeah, I'm gonna name some names here. I think one of the tragedies we've seen is the fall of the Daily Show and the Right Stuff. I think back in 2016, they were fresh, they were funny, they were outrageous. The Chateau Autiste and the Meraki parodies, they were great. And these guys, something turned in them after Charlottesville and after they got doxxed. And their show just isn't any fun to listen to anymore.
I mean, I've seen I sort of detached from a lot of the American stuff after 2018 sort of time. And so I haven't watched much of it. And it's not that I've got anything against them. I just sort of detached. I'm sure they don't watch much of my stuff either. But I do see occasional clips. And fuck's sake, it's so negative and angry.
That's exactly what we need not to be.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I understand there is a place for righteous indignation. And if you watch someone like the Critical Drinker, it's not like he never gets mad. It's not like he never calls out the people who need it. But on the other hand, it's not just a constant total drag of, you know, esoteric Holocaust denial and, you know, woe is me-ism. I mean, yeah, there's a lot to be angry about, sure, but, you know, that's people...
See, this, I do agree with you that this is what TRS used to do so well. Apart from anything else, they did very well. It was an upbeat show. And so when I say that it's, you know, the clips I've seen from it recently are angry and ranting, it's because I remember how it used to be. And it was upbeat. It was something you'd watch for a laugh. I don't know, maybe it's still funny nowadays, but all I can go by is what I've seen. But anyway, please continue.
Yeah, I think we can't understate the importance of fun. We can't understate the importance of, you know, laughing when we need to. Again, you know, think of, and, you know, now he's passed away, but, and I know you don't have any history of listening to him, but Rush Limbaugh back in the 90s when he was constantly doing comedy bits, you know, updates and Paul Shanklin songs and all of that. And that's what brought a lot of people in the door to him. You know, that's...
Well, there is the phrase about you catch more flies with honey than vinegar or whatever it is.
Right. And, you know, there's plenty of room in our thing for lots of people spread across our thing. You know, I think there is a place for, you know, Nerdrotic, Geeks and Gamers, Critical Drinker. I think there's a place for, you know, Christopher Cantwell, you know, guys like that. I think there's a place for Mencius Smallbug, you know, but let's remember the importance of people who bring others in the door who just, you know, again, we're pretty far along. Although I wonder if we are that far along, because just before we started the show, speaking of movies, I sent you a movie trailer that is very much the talk of the town on this side of the pond.
Right. Well, let's just say it's a forthcoming film called Civil War. Now, I didn't have much to say to you about it because I wasn't sure what angle you were taking on it. It looks timely. I'm not sure, given who wrote it. I forgot. It said by the writer of and named three other films, but I can't remember which films they were. But I remember thinking that's not altogether encouraging.
So it could turn out to be awful still, sure. It could turn out to be woke, sure. It doesn't look it from the trailer. And people are criticizing things like the setup is apparently that an alliance led by Texas and California secede from the Union and all hell breaks loose. And of course that would never happen. But I think the fact that he's making the political premise ridiculous allows him in some way to dodge the politics of it, which, you know, if he was going to get into the politics behind the war, he would be under enormous pressure to take the woke line on it. But by making it a fault line that doesn't exist and could never happen, he can just sort of dodge that whole thing, get out of the way of it.
Well, what is the fault line?
Well, the fault line is...
Sorry to interrupt it.
Well, the fault lines, multiple, are obviously right versus left, but also very much rural versus urban.
Right.
Those are where the fault lines are. So, you know, Texas and California joining forces against New York and Washington, D.C. is just... That's never going to happen. But again, it kind of gets that whole thing out of the way. So we can just take a look at, hey, you know, if something like this really did happen, what would it look like? And I think what's interesting about the reaction to it is that every, you know, because I've watched a lot of reaction videos to it, 10 years ago, everyone would have been, oh, come on, that's stupid, that'll never happen. These days, the reaction is all, yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we're, you know, not surprised. Not, you know, there are a lot of people calling it predictive programming. So, you know, it's nobody seems taken aback by this premise anymore. And that'll show you where we're at.
Yeah, I think there's no love lost at this point between the left and the right. It depends, obviously, how you define those, especially the right. See, that in itself is a whole messy thing. But clearly the two, and I'm not even sure how much that axis is still relevant, left and right. But it's not appropriate, but and yet it's still used. It still does fit in a way, even though it kind of shouldn't.
By the way, a comment here by Cronin in the chat. It's not true. There are more right-wingers in California than Texas. Us just outnumbers us. Yeah, bro, native son of San Jose right here until I left 5 years ago. I know. But, you know, I understand that, you know, if all hell breaks loose, hey, you know, State of Jefferson looks like something might actually end up happening. And hey, if it is, I'm the first one to move back. Right? But, you know, that's, again, it's city versus rural. You know, where Kern County's at, where Siskiyou County's at, you know, it's not where the Bay Area's at, and it's not where greater LA is at, and that's where all the people are. So, but, you know, California is another question. That state, one of the reasons why I left is that it's economically doomed. It's a state that's economy is based on three things: Silicon Valley, Hollywood, and Central Valley agriculture. Silicon Valley ain't what it used to be at all. It's really not going to be, you know, that kind of boomtown thing that we had going for 20 years. That's all gone. Hollywood is collapsing on itself, just like the music industry did 15 years ago. And, you know, and they're cutting off the water to the pistachio farms. So, you know, what the hell are we going to do now? Sorry, a little California inside baseball for everybody.
That's, yeah. Well, before we can talk about that later, but let's finish on the film first. Civil War, because that does seem like an interesting topic. And you've said that this now seems like a plausible scenario, even if the precise details of the scenario in the film, that obviously that's not going to happen. But the general idea of civil war is now something that is just in the air on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think in a way the left overestimate this, because they're constantly being told about the threat of far-right supremacists and insurrectionists, that, you know, we're just constantly on the verge of doing something dreadful. But meantime, we are thinking, well, they're the establishment is always on the verge of doing something dreadful. So there are tensions, both real and artificial, that are stirring. And so people, and people tend to also think, or at least I think, that there isn't really any nice way for this to be resolved. You know, basically, I mean, it's going to be horrible. So, I think in America, it probably will be civil war. So it's a not just a plausible scenario. It feels just at this point inevitable.
Well, you know, the problem is you look at wars of the past, and there were lots of people before pretty much every single one of them saying this is coming, right? I mean, the first American Civil War, people were saying for years before that, it's coming. World War One, if you read Howard's End, you know, there's tons of, you know, echoes in there of a coming war between England and Germany. World War Two, same thing. Now, you know, I think people are looking around for an off-ramp, for an exit ramp, but there increasingly isn't one. I don't know if you saw in the news, up until last weekend, one of the statues at Arlington Cemetery. So for those of you overseas, Arlington National Cemetery is a military cemetery just outside of Washington, D.C., where any American killed in combat in any war is entitled to be buried there. So there are graves from every war that America has ever fought. And there was, until last weekend, a monument at Arlington that was known as the Reconciliation Monument, which was literally a monument to reconciliation between the North and the South, that was erected in the 1920s when the last of the Civil War veterans on both sides were getting pretty elderly. And they all came together and they built this monument to reconciliation with each other. You know, let's move past this. Let's build this nation together. And last weekend they tore it down. It was under some kind of order and they came by with a big crane and they demolished it. Now on the grounds that it was among other things, a Confederate memorial. Now let me put it this way. When millions of people took to the streets of Eastern Europe in 1991 with hammers and chisels and tore down statues that represented communism, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say the message they were trying to send was they were sick of communism and they didn't want any more. So if you go and tear down something called the Reconciliation Monument, what's that saying that you want?
Yeah. Yeah, they're not interested in negotiation or reconciliation. They're interested in conquest of the right.
Yeah. And, you know, I took it seriously. I moved, again, you know, live my whole life in the big city, California. And 5 years ago, I was like, I can't be here anymore. And I ended up in a little village in southern Appalachia with a cabinet full of AR-15s, which I had never owned a gun in my life until I was 43 years old. And so, you know, kind of not where I thought I'd be at this point, but hey, and let me, before anyone brings up the idea of Fed posting, I'm going to say again and again and again what I've said on Gab and what I've said everywhere that I can. Any use of force on our side must be only local and only defensive in nature. Do not go out there starting trouble. Don't go out there doing anything violent. You protect yourself, your neighbors, your family, your friends, your town. But, you know, don't go out looking for trouble.
Yes. I'm just, my memory has stirred of when I first came to America in 2016 and you met me at the San Francisco airport. And then we went to your place, and then the next day you were showing me your guns. That was a thing, and I made a video at the time about it.
Anyone from Europe, if you come to America, especially the Midwest and the South, one of the things that Americans tend to like to do is show off our guns to you. if we offer you the chance to go shooting, we're just like being totally polite.
Yes. Yes. Well, it is a novelty for us. Although apparently they're not as banned in even in Britain as people tend to think. I don't really know. I don't know the details, but it all goes back to various bad incidents like the Dunblane massacre and all that. But that's a whole other thing. I think that it does seem like a lot of people on the left simply hate us, and there is, to me, it just seems incredible and completely unworkable. I mean, their worldview is crazy and full of contradictions, but they just don't care. It's sort of, well, hysterical. It's almost like they're simply allergic to anything traditional. Even the very idea, it's just, if it's traditional, then it's bad. And that's the end of the matter. So anyone who embodies that in any way is their enemy. And that really just, it makes conflict inevitable.
Well, they're fanatics, you know. And they absolutely, you know, the theme again and again, especially going back to a guy like Nerdrotic or Geeks and Gamers and all that, is, dude, they just wanted to be left alone. You know, you'd see that again and again during Gamergate, these memes with people saying, I just wanted to play games.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted Star Wars. You know, there's this quote, and I'm just, again, disclaimer, McDisclaimer. I did not say this. This is Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He said, quote, the most terrifying force of death comes from the hands of men who wanted to be left alone. They try so very hard to mind their own business and provide for themselves and those they love. They resist every impulse to fight back, knowing the forced and permanent change of life that will come from it. They know that the moment they fight back, their lives as they have lived them are over. The moment the men who wanted to be left alone are forced to fight back, it is a form of suicide. They are literally killing off who they used to be, which is why when forced to take up violence, these men who wanted to be left alone fight with unholy vengeance against those who murdered their former lives. They fight with raw hate and a drive that cannot be fathomed by those who are truly play-acting at politics and terror. True terror will arrive at these people's door, and they will cry, scream, and beg for mercy. But it will fall upon the deaf ears of the men who just wanted to be left alone.
Mm. Someone said in the chat that if there were a civil war between the left and the right, the right would lose because they don't have the funding, they don't have the organization, they're too individualistic and not willing to sacrifice. What would you say about that?
How much funding did the Taliban have?
Well, I'm guessing the presumption is that the American government would be much more ruthless with domestic so-called terrorists than it was with the Taliban.
I'm not too sure about that. I mean, look, tell me when the American military has won a war like this. They lost in Vietnam. They lost in Iraq. They lost in Afghanistan. They're not very good at this. Plus, of course, a large amount of the military would either defect or would not be very helpful to the government, to the left. Who's in the U.S. military now? A bunch of incompetents. Look at the recruiting crisis the military is having.
That is interesting, isn't it? And again, it's a cause for hope for those people who would be opposing the establishment.
Yeah, you know, someone once said, and I wish I could give them credit, that as empires fall, they get simultaneously more oppressive and more incompetent. I can tell you for sure, my local sheriff around here is taking the side of the people. And if no other reason, because the people are their neighbors and know where they live. You know, if you want to see what it would look like, So the example outlined in that movie, Civil War, I don't think it's exactly it. I think it would look a lot more like some mix of Ireland, Northern Ireland in the 1970s, Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and some of what's going on in Ukraine right now. But you know, it would be super duper rough. And I think if anything, more like Ireland and Yugoslavia than anything else. There's a movie out there called 71. Was it Jean de Bont? Let's see. Yann Demarge. And it's about a young British soldier who gets separated from his unit in Belfast in 1971 and has to find his way back home. If you want to see shades of what I think it would look like, that's a good place to start. But yeah, it would be a huge mess. And people are like, well, how would you fight drones? Well, you know, drones use fuel. Fuel goes on trucks that go on highways. If the trucks stop showing up, what happens to the drones? You know, that kind of thing. So you got to realize domestic military bases in the U.S. are not very protected. They're not very hardened. They're often in the middle of urban areas where, to clear enough ground to support a place like MacDill Air Force Base, you'd have to tear down half of Tampa. You're not going to do that. You know, yeah, drones don't work in populated areas. You know, the idea that it would be even as conventional a war as something like Vietnam, no, I don't think it would be. I think it would be an absolute mess. You know, and one of the reasons that I'm out here in Southern Appalachia is, look, you know, it's not that I'm 50 years old and not exactly ripped. I have no relevant combat experience, no relevant military experience. I wouldn't be of all that much help. So here I am, you know, trying to maybe keep my head down, but you know, you do what you can do.
Mm. I've just looked the film up on Wikipedia, and I can't believe it, that the main actress is Kirsten Dunst. Because yeah. I watched the trailer and didn't realize that was Kirsten Dunst. She's really got bloody old.
Oh, God, she was so hot as Mary Jane back in the day. Oh, my gosh.
I've always fancied her. I didn't recognize her. Holy shit.
Yeah, you know who someone brought up the other day was Elizabeth Hurley.
And oh, yeah.
She looks great for a woman her age, but oh my, she was so hot in that first Austin Powers movie. Oh my gosh.
I never saw it, but I remember the poster. Yeah. Well, I mean, we can't just talk about hot women for the rest of the stream. So I went to Wikipedia to find out what the premise of this film is, but it doesn't say much. It just says, a family traveling across the United States struggle to survive during a near-future civil war where the government becomes a dystopian dictatorship and partisan extremist militias regularly commit political violence. So the left-right thing is not even mentioned there.
Yeah, I think he's going to try and steer clear of real-world politics, specifically so he does not have to take a side in them.
Right, okay.
And that's probably the smart thing to do. You know, he can make most of the movie he wants to make and not get canceled for it. And yeah. Let's see, from someone who asked in the chat, yes, I do have an AR-10. I also have an M1 Garand if I want to go big caliber. And a 308 bolt rifle.
Right. So, Uzi 9mm?
No, actually, I don't own an Uzi.
Plasma rifle in the 40-watt range?
I would totally.
Of course. Wouldn't we both? Well, okay, someone just told me that the Super Chat bot hasn't been working. I've just restarted it, so hopefully it will work now. Thank you for letting me know that.
By the way, if we're going to talk about woke things that have gotten ruined, how about the Doctor?
Oh, for fuck's sake. Look, I avoid it like the plague now. The last episode I watched was Peter Capaldi's final one. This is the matter of Doctor Who. And I try not to... I mean, it's someone else's program now. It hasn't been mine since 1989, right? And everything, like the videos that I watched in the 90s, yeah, I liked them, and it's a part of my life. It will always have been there, you know. But ultimately, it's a kid's science fiction show. I mean, it's not something that I want as an adult to have much, you know, place much faith in. And certainly, the new version from 2005 was never my kind of thing.
Eccleston actually came out and said that he wouldn't come back to the role because it's too woke now.
Did he say that?
Yeah, I did.
Oh. Oh, wow. I'm surprised.
Yeah, he seemed pretty upset about it.
I'll have to look that up. I mean, after Capaldi, it was the woman. And I steered clear of it for just various reasons. I was going to watch it with someone else, and it never happened. And then I've heard that they've just done these three specials for Christmas. For the 60th anniversary, and just pretty dreadful reviews all around for those. And now it's the black guy, and who's like sort of gay black guy. And this will be the Christmas special coming up, I guess, on Christmas Day. And, you know, I just have no interest in it at all. The only interest I have in it is of all things, I started writing a Substack essay today about this. Before the stream started. It's just about the evolution of the writer, Russell T. Davis. And that interests me, his evolution. But I think he's a nauseating man. And, you know, not that. I mean, he's talented in a way, but I remember someone saying he's no Joss Whedon. Well, you'll know about Joss Whedon.
You just gave me a sad reflecting on the fact that Firefly was 22 years ago.
Jesus Christ. I fancy Summer Glau as well.
Well, let's see. Black guy and a woman walking to a TARDIS. Yeah. Less TARDIS, more TARDS.
Look, I've heard that climate change is going to be a big thing in the new series. And the whole gay stuff, it's going to be very different. As if it wasn't woke enough, Russell T. Davis is saying it's going to be even more, you know, much more like that. Partly because of the Disney funding, probably. The BBC have made a deal with Disney. So the budget is massively increased, apparently. It's not going to... I don't know how it's even going to look like a British TV show at this point. It'd be fucking CGI all over the place. So, I don't know. I don't know who this is supposed to appeal to. I guess just, you know, morons who don't know anything else.
Well, yeah, I mean... So, by the way, first, who is your doctor? Because, like, everyone has their doctor, the one that they think of. Now, for me, it's Tom Baker. You will always be the doctor.
I don't know what accent that's supposed to be. But nonetheless, thank you for doing it. The doctor that I don't like to talk about this subject because most of my fans are not interested in Doctor Who, so that kind of helps me to not talk about it. But since you've brought it up, my doctor, it was, well, when I discovered the program in the late 80s, it was Sylvester McCoy. So that's like, you know, it's like you never quite get over your first doctor, so to speak. It's the one that you always associate with the program. Yeah. And I do think he's underrated.
And speaking of which, who's your James Bond?
Well,
because mine, of course, born in 1973, mine's Roger Moore. Just has to be.
Yeah. Well, I guess Timothy Dalton was the James Bond when I was small, and then Pierce Brosnan got it. I've not seen any of the Daniel Craig ones. I actually do like Timothy Dalton, and I think he's bloody good in the role. But, look, I mean, Sean Connery is just effortless in the role. So I would probably have to say Sean Connery. Like, it's the standard answer. Everyone says Sean Connery.
I think my top three are probably, well, I mean, number one was You Only Live Twice for so very long. But Skyfall was just magnificent. What a great movie. So I'd say maybe Skyfall, You Only Live Twice, and then maybe GoldenEye.
Yeah, Skyfall is the one that I'm really the only one that I'm interested in seeing. I mean, Quantum of Solace apparently was awful. Casino Royale was really well received. So then Quantum of Solace, then Skyfall, and then what was the fourth one?
You know what? I liked Quantum of Solace.
Oh,
it wasn't as good as Casino Royale or Skyfall, but I think it suffers unfairly in comparison to the films before and after it. It's not as good as either of them, but I still thought it was pretty darn good.
Right, I've just got it up on here. So it's Casino Royale. And then 2 years later, Quantum of Solace. And then 4 years later, Skyfall. And then Spectre. And then No Time to Die. So he did five.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, No Time to Die. Have you seen that? What's that like?
No, I haven't seen it yet. But, you know, look, I thought Spectre was okay. Again, I didn't think it was awful. I just thought, you know, it's not as good as the ones before it, but it's pretty good. It's okay.
Okay. What did you think of Daniel Craig's Bond?
I like Daniel Craig's Bond. I really do. I like Craig's Bond. I like Judy Dench's M, and I like the new M, too. Who's the new M?
Is it John Cleese?
Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, all right. Okay. Oh, yes, John Cleese is the new Q, isn't he?
Well, he was the new Q, and now it's Penn Wishaw.
Oh, God.
He's okay. He's okay.
Yeah, I guess so.
He's one of those guys I can stand. There are a lot of people in British entertainment that I can stand, mostly because I don't know a lot about their personal lives and what they do, you know, what their political thoughts are. But I still like the whole Richard Ayoade, Matt Berry circle that do those shows.
Yeah, yeah. I know the ones you mean. Yeah.
Matt Berry's the IT Crowd was a great show. Sorry, you know, just as someone who, you know, lived in Silicon Valley, I just love that show. I probably shouldn't, but I do.
I'm surprised. Was there not a, you know, an Atlantic divide making it less relevant to you? I'm surprised that it would fit into the Silicon Valley thing.
Oh, it does. Now, among other things, I did tell you that I am part English, didn't I?
Well, you must have told me that back in the day, but I'd forgotten. Sorry.
So, let's see. My great-grandfather, after whom I am named, so I won't tell you his name, was in the fire brigade in Woolwich. during the Blitz and was killed when a burning building collapsed on him. My grandmother, his daughter, was in her youth a very pretty blonde English girl. And one day she went to a hop and she met my grandfather, who was there with the Mighty 8th Air Force, and married him and came back to New York, where they had my mother 2 years later. So all of that sort of, you know, I remember staying up late with my grandmother. At the time, public TV would play reruns of Benny Hill. And I was way too young to totally understand what was going on. But the cool thing about Benny Hill is you kind of don't have to. I mean, there's humor for all ages there. So
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd watch the English shows with her.
Did you want to be Ernie, the fastest milkman in the West?
No. But we watched all the 80s, you know, Penelope Keith sitcoms and all of those. Very, very super duper English. The only thing that I found that was too English for me, like so English that I just couldn't get the humor, was Only Fools and Horses.
Ah, yes. Yes, I can understand that.
That show is so English.
Like, it's more. You know, it's usually voted the most popular sitcom ever in Britain.
I mean, I get it. I know why it's funny, but it's just a little too English even for me. And I just, you know, I suck down shows like Red Dwarf, like Blackadder, you know, the great Gimme More, Lex, Gimme More. But, yeah, it just goes a little too far.
Lex, wasn't that Australian?
I thought it was English.
I think it was Australian. And I never actually saw it. But, again, I fancied the girl. Because I used to get these sci-fi magazines. And I remember, when was that, 95?
Oh, Keeping Up Appearances? Someone brought that up in the chat. I love Keeping Up Appearances. Like I said, all those Penelope Keith sitcoms from like the 80s and 90s, I'm down with it. To the Manor Born, I'm in.
Yeah, I just googled Lex. I'm not surprised I fancied the girl in it. Bloody hell. No, very sexy. I never saw it. So I can't comment on that, sorry. But Only Fools and Horses is very working class. Maybe that's why it's sort of difficult for an American to get it, because it's you kind of have to understand that. Like, obviously, Keeping Up Appearances is kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, so to say. It's this woman who's a ridiculous snob, but I think that's quite easy to understand. Only Fools and Horses is really about these guys at the bottom end of the spectrum, and they're trying to make it big, and it's all about that, and it's all about how they're looked down on by the rest of society. It's about Britain in the 80s, really.
Yeah, you know, it's very much, again, very much a product of its time and place. Have I ever seen Fawlty Towers? Dude, of course I have seen Fawlty Towers.
It's very good. I've said before, it's one of the few things that live up to its hype. It's actually as good as you've heard.
There is a TV series I keep recommending to you and you keep not watching, but I'm going to bring it up again. It's a series from about 2005, 2006 called Monkey Dust.
I've seen one episode of Monkey Dust.
That is just a brilliant show. It's so beautifully black-pilled. If you get the chance, watch every episode. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's just amazing.
I remember that it never came out on DVD. I think there were three seasons, and only the third one was ever put out on DVD.
I'm pretty sure it's on iPlayer.
Right, right, okay. Because DVD's sort of irrelevant now, isn't it, for most people? But yeah, I remember seeing it on TV and thinking it was very clever. And I intended to sort of seek it out, but it never happened.
It's just, it's beautifully black-pilled. It's going to depress the hell out of you, but you should watch it anyway.
I imagine that watching it now is a sort of time capsule to the mid-2000s.
In a way, yeah. It also because it is very heavy on music. So it's got a lot of music of that time in it. Like a lot, but a lot of good stuff that'll stick with you. Like one of my favorite scenes is set to Lovely Head by Goldfrapp.
Oh, yes. We both, you know, I think we've talked about Goldfrapp before, and Alison Goldfrapp is rather attractive.
And another one actually introduced me to the song Sunrise by Pulp, which is another really great song.
I don't know that song, actually. Sorry. I'll tell you, though, just on the matter of a time capsule to the mid-2000s, I happened to catch some clips from Peep Show a few months ago, and bloody hell. It again reminds you that, oh yeah, time has continued passing. It's really not 2005 anymore. Things have changed. When you hadn't really noticed, you know, it's like, oh my God, that actually was a long time ago. Because first of all, almost everyone's white, and no one's got smartphones, and Wi-Fi isn't a thing, and dating websites aren't a thing. So it's still kind of like things used to be when, you know, men and women would meet in somewhere in real life. They would first encounter each other. That's how they would meet. And it was just sort of more sane, more normal than life nowadays.
So someone asked what pop song? Sunrise, which was put over an absolutely brilliant scene, which I won't share with you because you just go watch Monkey Dust. Promise me. Actually, there's that, and there's one other movie that I've been trying to get you to watch forever, which is a movie called Melody.
Oh, yeah.
1971.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one that's going to give you nostalgia for a place that you had never been.
Yeah. Is it rural England or brutalist England or what?
I think it's somewhere in northern England in 1971. So right. It very much gives you that same kind of vibe as Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, even though Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was actually filmed in Germany.
Well, it's obviously filmed in Germany. I mean, that's a baffling film where it's kind of like the first Hellraiser film where you've got no idea where it's supposed to be set. You know, it could be America, it could be Britain. It's very weird. With Willy Wonka, it's like they're speaking English. It's obviously Germany in the architecture, and then half the characters are Jews. Well, half the actors. It's a very strange film.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a new Willy Wonka movie, and I think they keep missing the point on these, which would be the movie I would want to see would be, here it is 50 years later, Charlie Bucket is now elderly and decides he wants to give away the factory the way that Willy did, and he stages a contest and invites a bunch of 21st century kids in with all of their 21st century neuroses.
So, well, that, yeah, that I could see that being a fitting development. I don't know what Tim Burton did with it. And this new one, I read a bad review of it earlier today, actually, the new one. Are you a fan of the original film?
Oh, look, you can't be from my generation and not love the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh,
I mean, it's one of the foundational movies of our youth. You know, that's right up there with Star Wars.
Yeah. God, it must have been Star Wars must have been amazing. You're exact age, like to be 8 when The Empire Strikes Back was coming out.
Oh, I'll tell you a story. Yeah. My very first memory, like in life ever, is it had to have been the fall of 1977. My dad took me to a drive-in movie to go see the original Star Wars. I sat bundled up in a blanket on the roof of his old light blue Opel, and we watched that movie. And the thing I remember most was that first scene where the door of the Tantive IV blows out, and there's this cloud of smoke, and Vader comes through it for the first time. And this is your first time ever seeing Darth Vader. And my dad turned to me and said, "So, think that's the bad guy?" Yeah, Dad, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that it must have been amazing. I can't imagine the hype. Especially for the second one and the third one.
Return of the Jedi is the movie that I have seen the most times in a movie theater. So that would be 18 times. I saw it. 13. I saw it 13 times in 1983. Four more times for the 1997 re-release. And one more time this year when they did the 40th anniversary re-release. So, yep.
So you must be one of the Star Wars fans who knows the differences between the different versions.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And were you dismayed when they brought out the... In the late 90s? Was it the...
The special editions?
Yeah, the special editions. Yeah, how did you feel about that?
Mixed. Mostly positive. Most of the changes to the effects were for the better. The new music was for the better. So I was fairly positive on them. And you know what? I think in retrospect, the prequels benefit from time. I think, and looking back on it now, The Phantom Menace was a pretty darn good Star Wars film. I know a lot of people were disappointed in it. I think it's a pretty darn good film.
We just lost half of our viewers, Auntie Dem.
Yeah, well, Simon Pegg hated it, but then again, Simon Pegg, you know.
Well, The Phantom Menace and then Attack of the Clones was the first film that was shot digitally. Did you know that?
Not surprised. Mm. And, you know, even Attack of the Clones, I mean, Christopher Lee was so good in that. I mean, how can you show any hate for the guy?
Again, I haven't seen the prequels. I've only seen the original three, and then the bloody Force Awakens.
Oh, dude! Someone brought up the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. What a great show! What a great show! I remember watching that in the late 80s. That was just wonderful. And they should. They should so do something with that.
I heard that they were going to do a new series like that. Something about him when he was, in his 30s or something.
I don't know. I just don't trust them to do anything and to not woke it up.
Yeah. 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 I googled the film Melody. I'm going to tell you something that will blow your mind.
Yeah?
The director also directed the very first ever episode of Doctor Who.
Not surprised.
Mm-hmm. Varys Hussain. Yeah, he was, or is, he's still alive now, unbelievably. Indian guy. It's surprisingly, not really surprising. That the Doctor Who was very It was Dewey. You know, the producer was a female, a Jewess, and it was conceived partly by a Canadian Jew called Sidney something. I've forgotten his name. And the director of the first story was this British Indian guy who's also gay. So for all of that, 1963, and again, as I often say, British TV is nowhere near as Jewish as American TV. And that was even more the case back then. And yet, that was the mix that went into Doctor Who. I mean, there were, I think, at least two other guys involved in its conception. Anthony Coburn was one of them. I've forgotten who the other one was. But nonetheless, surprisingly multicultural there. And anyway, he also directed that film Melody, and he's now 85. Waris Hussein.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of 85-year-olds, don't go see Ridley Scott's new Napoleon movie. It's proof that you should never, ever, ever let an Englishman direct a movie about Bonaparte.
I've seen it. I avoid Ridley Scott films because I honestly just don't like his stuff. I mean, what did you think of Prometheus and Covenant? No, I had exactly the same feeling about it. Yeah,
they were so close to actually being good.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, good. Not brilliant, but they were close to being good. I would agree with that. But what would you say was the last really good Ridley Scott film?
Oh, boy. Let me look over his filmography here. I mean, my favorite of his is Aliens. My favorite of his is Blade Runner.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, what about Thelma and Louise?
No.
Legend?
No. Hold on. Let me look at the filmography. Okay, The Duelist was actually really good.
Alien's
good. Blade Runner is my favorite of his. Legend is great. It's classic. Black Rain, that's a good one. Black Hawk Down, great movie. Kingdom of Heaven, almost a really great movie.
Apparently the director's cut's a lot better. I thought it was... I saw the normal version. I thought it was bloody awful, actually.
So that's about it.
But what about Gladiator?
It was good, but it got the best picture because it was released in a really weak year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could agree with that, yeah. I don't know. Gladiator's just not my kind of film. I think a lot of... And I don't really hold it. I mean, I think people like it for the same reason they like Master and Commander, which is that Russell Crowe is a very manly guy. And he makes... And those are two very manly films. And so if that kind of stuff appeals to you, then obviously you're going to love those films. I just find it a bit boring. Gladiator. I can understand the appeal of it, though. Like a guy getting revenge for his family being killed, his wife and son. We all like a good revenge film, so I can understand. I didn't really like Gladiator. Apparently, he's doing a sequel to it now.
I've heard.
Which I don't know what that's going to be. But, so we're going to say about Napoleon. So, prominent. Prometheus and Covenant were, I mean, they're good. I can see they're well made and all that. I just think they're muddled. They bit off more than they could chew. It's... The intellectual substance just isn't there. And they're not very effective horror. And they're not scary. It just feels like a big misfire to me. Obviously, the character of David is quite interesting, but I don't find him as interesting as other people seem to. Again, maybe it's just not the film for me. Napoleon, actually, Napoleon's just a bad film. It's just a bad film.
Whoa!
You're roboting. I think your mic might need to be reconnected.
All right, hold on, just a sec.
I don't know where he's gone. I think he's going to come back. Don't worry.
I'm here.
Hi. Excellent.
Mike, better?
Okay. Yes, much better. Yeah. Okay. So Napoleon. So take it away.
All right. I went and saw it with my friend Craig Langley, who is an author in our thing. In fact, he's just a published author. And I am going to link you in the private chat to his new book. And he has been allied with our side for a very long time. He absolutely hated it. Primarily because he said, number one, Joaquin Phoenix was a miscast. Because number two, that's just not Napoleon Bonaparte.
Yes.
You know, Joaquin Phoenix plays him like this brooding loner, you know, trying to keep it together. Where every account of the real Napoleon Bonaparte, it was like... it was like meeting, you know, Mick Jagger times Conor McGregor. You know, the guy just oozed charm and confidence and all of that. So it wasn't Napoleon.
Yeah, it was kind of emo.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But so, I mean...
What did you think of those... Because I didn't understand what the fuck they were thinking with this. The sex scenes.
Yeah.
They would sort of gyrate behind her. What the fuck was that?
Dude, I am telling you, do not let an Englishman make a movie about Bonaparte. They will never, ever, ever give Bonaparte a fair shake. It's just too ingrained in their DNA... to hate Napoleon Bonaparte.
I don't know. You might be right. I just didn't understand what they were going for. I really didn't understand it. And at the end, I thought this was weird. Maybe you have a different opinion here. Remember at the end when the screen crawl comes up and it lists how many bloody soldiers were killed in each of his wars, each of his battles. What the heck? I've never seen that before in a film. I don't understand. It's like they were blaming him for getting all these men killed. Well, as if it was his fault. These were his wars.
Dude, it's do not let an Englishman make a movie about Bonaparte. They are just always going to hate him. It's like having a Jewish director make a movie about Bad German Mustache Man. They're never, you know, you can plead all you like. They're just never going to make him anything but contemptible in every sense.
I don't know. I wouldn't say it was that simple with this film. I think in some, they did show him to be a military genius, a very talented tactician. The trouble is that didn't marry up with any other of aspects of his character. It was just sort of there. But then, meantime, he's a brooding emo twat who weird around his wife. Remember when he was rutting when he wanted sex. Again, I'm left thinking, what the hell is this? I just don't understand.
Honestly, you know what he should have done? What Ridley Scott should have done was make a movie about the Duke of Wellington instead. Because the few minutes that he was on screen, the guy playing the Iron Duke was really interesting.
I thought he was good. Yeah, his name's Rupert. I think it's Rupert. Is it Rupert Everett? But yeah, it was quite good. Yeah. I agree.
I think that's what he should have done. Now, someone asked me in chat, my take on David Lynch. What the hell was going on with that that remake of Twin Peaks?
Well, I haven't seen it, so don't spoil it.
Oh, no, look.
Sorry.
I can't spoil it for you because I watched every last episode of it and I still don't understand it.
Oh, well, I've been directed to a 4-hour documentary, which apparently explains the whole thing. I don't know if you'd be interested in that.
That was just, what in the world is going on there? I don't get it. But I mean, he can be a good director. I just, you know, and I like the original Twin Peaks, but the remake, I don't get it.
I've seen the original and I like all of it. I like the first season, the second season with some, I mean, excepting some subplots. I don't like the stuff with that one-eyed woman. You know, when she becomes she gets hit in the head and she becomes a cheerleader again. She thinks she's 18. I don't like that at all. But that aside, I love the second season as well. And I also love the film, which some fans don't like the film, but I did. So I like all of it. And then the third season is, see, this is why there's some pressure there, because it matters to me, because I like all the rest of it. So I'm nervous about watching the third one, the new 2017 season. Especially because what people say about it is so divisive, you know?
Look, I'm not saying it was bad. I'm saying I didn't understand it. Which reminds me of a story. So did you know that the original casting that the Wachowskis had in mind for The Matrix was supposed to be Will Smith as Neo and Sean Connery as Morpheus?
What?
Yeah, absolutely true. Will Smith,
like the original Matrix film.
Yes.
Ewan McGregor as...
No, it was Will Smith.
Oh, right, sorry.
As Neo, and Sean Connery as Morpheus. Now, Will Smith turned the
role... How did I beat you?
I know. Will Smith turned the role down because he was already on this play, Wild Wild West, which, you know... And someone asked him about that years later, and he was just like, look, you know, yeah, bad call, but Keanu was so good in that role. You know, whatever. Sean Connery turned the role down because he didn't understand it. You know, they sent him the script and he didn't understand the script. So then, of course, you know, The Matrix becomes this enormous hit. And Connery decides that that's it. He made a mistake not taking this role. He's going to take the very next role that he doesn't understand. So the next role script he got that he didn't understand was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And of course, the reason that he didn't understand it was nobody understood League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. So
yeah, that's not a film that's remembered with any fondness, is it?
No, not a way to go out. Not a way to go out.
No. But did he not do the, what was it called? Was it The Rock?
The Rock was a great movie. He had a pretty good 90s. The Russia House is an underrated film. I very much enjoy it, even though it is not talked about a lot these days. The Hunt for Red October was just outrageous. Just wonderful. Great film. I mean, John McTiernan had such a great 90s, just had such a great late 80s with Predator, Die Hard, and The Hunt for Red October all back-to-back. Like, how can you beat that?
Well, what about the composer Basil Poliduris, who did who did Conan, RoboCop, and then The Hunt for Red October?
Oh, just amazing. Just amazing. by the way, the small bit of trivia, they wanted to give Connery a monologue in Hunt for Red October that didn't exist in the book. They wanted him to give a speech to the crew. So McTiernan tried to find a script doctor to come in and write this speech, which turned out to be the We Sail Into History speech. And who he ended up getting was John Milius, the guy who wrote Apocalypse Now, the first two Dirty Harry films, the first Conan the Barbarian film, and was the model for Walter in The Big Lebowski.
Mm.
So that's why that's such a great speech, is Milius wrote it.
Wow, I didn't know that. It reminds me of Crimson Tide from about 5 years later when they got Tarantino in to do the script doctoring for that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, again, that's another movie The Critical Drinker brings up as being one of those, man, they don't make them like that anymore, movies.
Well, did you see the new Top Gun? Because a lot of people said that was a weirdly anachronistic film for this age.
It was. It was. It was a callback to the original, which, I mean, that was such a unique era. You know, that you would say that original Top Gun could only have existed in that mid-80s Reagan era. And, you know, maybe it could, but enough people wanted to go back to that they were able to make a second movie.
That's a nice thought.
I mean, it's you know, in a way, it's almost like that in Civil War are bookends to each other. Because, I mean, look, we are seeing the end of the Pax Americana, the end of the American Empire. You know, if you look in the Civil War trailer, towards the end, they flash in these cards that say, "All empires fall." And that's something that really hits. There is very much this idea that we are getting ready for a turning. And that whole post-1991 era is getting ready to be overthrown. And that the American Empire is getting ready to join the Soviet Empire in the dustbin of 20th century empires. And, you know, that's very much something that's in the air. I think everybody's thinking of it. You know, what do we do... once that's over and once all these rules change?
Well, and who's going to be in charge? That's the other thing, the ambiguity about what is the West going to be subjected to? I mean, is Russia going to rule the world, set the tone?
I don't know that's the thing. Maybe nobody's going to be in charge. You know, that's the... maybe it's going to be this multipolar world with different spheres of influence. And if so, of course, then the question is, what happens to Europe?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, what scares me is that we're just going to be owned by China or whatever.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of options. You know, one of them is that Russia sort of makes all of Europe its sphere of influence. That could happen. Germany finds its balls is not completely out of question. It could, yeah, I'm gonna say that could happen. You know, there's a lot that could go on. But one thing is for sure that, I forget who said it, but someone said that Europe's turn as an open-air theme park for American tourists is just about over. I think it was Jim Kunstler, actually, who said that. And boy, oh boy, anyone who's been to Paris lately, you know.
See, I don't like that idea that Europe is just an America, a theme park in that way. Like, because that implies that without American wealth, we just wouldn't be looking after our history. We wouldn't be looking after preserving all these old buildings. But maybe we wouldn't be. I mean, maybe once that connection with a very wealthy America dissolves or America stops being so rich, then we will just be covered in, you know, all these museums will just fall into disrepair and be demolished and be replaced with some fucking awful glass and steel stuff that's funded by the Chinese or whatever. I don't know. I don't know who else it would be.
Well, yeah.
You know, the idea that our heritage is just going to disappear because it relies on American wealth is depressing, because we should have our own wealth. I mean, it shouldn't be like this. But we know that Germany and Russia have been kept apart for forever, so that Germany is always dependent on, well, it's always submissive to, subservient to, Pax Americana.
You know, there are countries starting to look past that. Japan has been slowly, quietly, but very definitely rebuilding its military, and especially its navy, to the point where, you know, in 1985, if China had tried to take Japan without American support for Japan, it would have been an open question. Now, you know, the Japanese are ready to remind the world that they are not just those nice PlayStation and anime people.
Yeah. I wonder about that. Again, it's a sort of free-for-all. Once America is no longer the world policeman, there's going to be so much activity and, what's the word? It's going to be fraught with people competing to grab resources and make a mark, become more powerful than they currently are.
Well, you know, the end of every empire ends up with people scrambling for the leftover money and power. What's going to happen when America becomes not what it was anymore? I don't know. Good question. But it's happening, you know. I mean, America will remain the global hegemon from chat. Alex DeLarge says, America will remain the global hegemon through the 21st century. Predictions of America's demise or decline have been made repeatedly. Yeah, they have been, but that doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. And now it looks more than ever. I mean, look, America is in unpayable debt. It can't recruit enough natives for its military. It hasn't won a war clean since 1945. It's politically divided in a way that it's never been. You know, this is not a recipe for continued power. You know, it's middle class is angry. You know, and not only that, the people it can recruit from its military are awful. You know, the military heritage of the United States depends on Midwesterners, but especially Southerners. They're just not showing up. Wouldn't you agree that America's dominance over Europe has increased as a result of the Russia-Ukraine war? No, I wouldn't. Not at all. Because Ukraine's going to lose. I know Russia had a rough early half of the war. They had a rough early half of World War II, too. A lot unexpected has happened, including the fact that what happened in Gaza showed that America doesn't have the resources to sustain two fronts, even of a proxy war. Russia has finally got its shit together. Ukraine is absolutely starting to fall apart. It's running out of men. It's conscripting 60-year-olds. This can't go on. And when Ukraine goes, that's going to be one of the moments that signals the end of America as global hegemon. And when you can really tell that is going to be when Germany jumps ship. If sometime after, so here's what I'm thinking is going to happen is somewhere this year, Ukraine's probably going to have to ask for a settlement. Zelensky's probably going to flee to his.
You obviously mean next year, 2024.
Yeah. Zelensky's going to flee for his estate in Miami. And then Europe's going to have some real thinking to do. Germany's going to have to really consider how much they like shivering in the dark. Because without Russian energy, continuing to not shiver in the dark is tough enough. Continuing to be a world economic power is even tougher. And America is a long way away. So we'll see.
I don't know. I wouldn't expect the change to happen so quickly as next year. But I get what you're saying. It's kind of triggered by the fallout from the Ukraine war. So the Ukraine war probably is going to finish next year. So yeah, that makes sense.
And I will tell everyone this. I'm old enough to remember being 15 years old, sitting on the couch with my dad in front of our little TV, old CRT TV, watching people walk out on the streets of Berlin with hammers to tear down the Berlin Wall. And I remember watching my dad literally with his mouth hung wide open, just in awe that this was happening, that this could possibly ever happen. So I don't know if what's going to happen next is going to be that fast and that dramatic. But I know that it can be that fast and that dramatic.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I can actually remember watching it on TV with my dad, oddly enough. Funny that. But yeah, it can be very fast indeed. That's a.
Yeah, I remember that. That was the
analogy. Sorry, go.
That was the year the last time U2 released an actually good album.
if only their decline had been so rapid.
I will defend U2 right up through and including Octung Baby. But after that, I just don't know what the fuck happened.
Do you like With or Without You? Because I've got, there's on YouTube, there's a 10-minute version of it with extra ukulele, and it's really good.
When U2 still sounded like Irishmen, they were good. But you know, as soon as they decided, ooh la la, we are Europeans. Oh, well, you know, that was different. And if you've listened to them from their latest residency out at the Sphere in Las Vegas, JFC, dude, I mean, Bono's voice sounds worse than Maiden does. You know, I'm here screeching at you. It sounds worse than me. Oh my gosh, what the hell happened?
Well, you know, I just discovered a group from the mid-80s. I'd never heard of them before. I don't know how this group had escaped me until like 2 months ago, called Book of Love. No? Not familiar. Well, very gay. Like, I think they were very popular in the gay scene. And anyway, it's like mid-80s electronic dance kind of stuff, pop music. There's one song that's really fucking catchy, and I really liked it. Anyway, I found a reunion concert by these people from like five, I think 2018. Holy shit. The woman's voice sounded absolutely awful. I couldn't believe how much she'd declined.
Yeah, I know.
And it's weird to hear it, because you think, like, it doesn't usually happen. Like, they usually get some training or whatever. Holy shit, she sounded dreadful.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it depends, you know. Like, I saw a video of Led Zeppelin from their Celebration Day reunion a few years ago. And Robert Plant, his voice is half of what it used to be, which means that it's still twice what everyone else's is. I mean, that dude, wow. Wanderer Zooropa by... Someone asked if I'm a fan of Wanderer Zooropa by U2. A little too late for me. They got a little too European for me by that point.
Well, how old was Roy Orbison when he died? Because his voice was still excellent when he died.
Oh, yeah.
Hold on. He was 52, actually, not that old. Let's find out how old Bono is. 63.
Wow.
Because I heard that the peak for the male voice is like 40.
I mean, look, it depends. There are some people who sound better at 80 than they ever did. Frank Sinatra sounded better at 80 than he ever was in his whole life. And he was pretty good in his whole life. So, I mean, it really depends. Who I just caught up with is Dead Can Dance. Lisa Gerrard still sounds just amazing.
Dead Can Dance. Now, what was their big song?
Oh, they did all kinds of, you know, medieval gothic stuff back in the day.
Somebody, I think it might have been Lichtmess, introduced me to them. But I can't remember what the big song was.
You know who I saw a few years ago? Was Blondie.
Oh.
And damn if Debbie Harry still can't belt that shit out like you wouldn't believe. She's just still amazing. I mean, she looks like she's Yoda's older sister, but damn, she can still sing.
What a shame. But yeah, she does look pretty haggard nowadays. I mean, yeah, Debbie Harry is, she was very attractive when she was young, but I just can't help thinking of, you know, every time I see a photo of her from the late 70s or whatever, I just can't help thinking of her being shagged by so many Jews in New York.
Yeah, well.
And it just makes it, ugh. It's kind of gross.
Yeah, you know, it is what it is. actually, the last concert I went to was Red Hot Chili Peppers last year, and they're still really good. Yeah, I know their politics are absolutely horrendously deplorable, but look, I'm a Californian. I have to love them. There's just no choice.
Well, why don't you tell us some bands that you think sort of sum up or epitomize California or reflect facets of Californian life?
Oh, I'm convinced you cannot understand Red Hot Chili Peppers until you spent some time in Los Angeles. It's just, they are such an L.A. band, and their music is so California, you know. And other than that, I mean, you know, you've got guys like Stone Temple Pilots. They're a good one. I just saw Rick Beato's interview with, let's see. Rick Beato's interview with Robert DeLeo, and man, that was so good. Chili Peppers Circa 94 and older is great. Listen, I understand, and I'm just looking at the chat here. I understand there's a lot of people for whom, like Mother's Milk is the last great Chili Peppers album. I gotta disagree with you, bro. I get it, but I'm still post mother's milk. California isn't sexy anymore. No, it's not. If you look on YouTube, there's a guy named Metal Leo, and he is still in the Bay Area, and he's been doing these tours around the different parts of the Bay Area, showing how much it's closed down, how much is, you know, not what it was, crime ridden, it's full of junk, full of garbage, and it's just heartbreaking. Because I remember it when it was at its heart, when its height, and it was just the greatest place in the world.
Well, I'll find some nice photos of California, but first, here's a photo that, well, you took this of me in your backyard in California. God, it's worse than I was expecting. The heady days of 2016.
So if you would say, yeah, there you go. And I still have that shotgun too. A little different furniture, but yeah. And I took you for communist pizza.
Yes, you did. It was so fun. And I really don't know if I thanked you enough at the time, but thank you for accommodating me. It was a great time.
It was
lovely. And we went to Berkeley. And you showed me around there, and you showed me around that university and different places. It was really fun.
I will second that. It most definitely was.
I mean, we could do a little nostalgia tour, but oh gosh, yeah, it's funny seeing that. I'm just looking through the Dangerous Haggis folder here. It's quite strange. I haven't looked at these photos in a long time, but here's one. You can explain this for people, because I think I've actually seen this location showing up in Antifa footage.
Let's see where you got.
There it is.
Oh, Zoller Gate. Yeah, that's the main gate in the University of California, Berkeley.
Well, then that explains it. I think 6 months later, Lawrence Southern was being chased around there by Antifa.
I was actually at the Trump rally in San Jose where they had that riot. And I missed out on the riot because I know the city too well. Basically, from where the Trump rally was, there's the obvious way out to where everyone was parked, and then there was the way you'd have to be from there to know to go, and I did that to get out of there fast and not get stuck in a traffic jam. That's why I missed the riot.
I see. And here is another. I don't really know what this is. Can't remember now. Can you remember that?
Oh, yeah, it's a camp anyway. It's on UC Berkeley campus.
Right, okay. And then I've also got this one. I don't know what this is. Oh, it's Harambee. I don't know if I used all of these photos in the videos. So, in fact, I probably didn't because I didn't have the editing facility. But, yeah, these are some photos that we took, Auntie Dem and me. There we go. Quite amusing, but I wanted to not go off on that diversion. I wanted to talk about California itself, because it does, in a certain sense, I don't think it would be overly pretentious to say that it summed up well America, the West, in the 50s, and obviously the 60s with the hippie, the late 60s with the hippies as well, but for a time it was this sort of utopia. And I wonder if you remember that. Well, I guess, no, you can't, by definition, you can't remember it, but
Karl Marx talked about creating a workers' paradise, but there has never been anything closer than a genuine workers' paradise for the white man than California in 1964. Everything you need, beauty, security, a roaring economy, plentiful time off, fun to be had. It was just beautiful. And we threw it all away for nothing.
See, I can only talk with reference to films. So, California in 1984 with the Terminator. It looks pretty bad.
Well, yeah, but it was supposed to.
Of course.
The thing about the 80s was it was very bad in certain isolated urban cores. If you were trying to go into South Central or something like that, it was going to be really bad, but it really didn't much escape those. Whereas now, the latest thing I saw was somebody tried an armed robbery on a jewelry store in Pleasant Hill. And it's like, dude, Pleasant Hill? Are you kidding me? That's like, upper middle class, Central. It's always been safe. It's always been nice. There's never been any crime there. It's the kind of place you'd walk around any time of the day or night. And now there's armed robberies there. What are you talking about? I mean, I understand, armed robbery in frickin' Hunter's Point. Sure. But Pleasant Hill, what the hell? The neighborhood I used to live in, there's been two murders on the local commuter train track since I left. Place used to be safe as you liked. But, now it's not only dangerous, but the danger is spreading.
See, for some reason, I associate you with Americana. It's funny because you weren't born until... 73. But whenever I see photos like the ones I'm going to show now, I always think of you. Here's this one, for example.
Let's have a look. Oh, man. Blatt's beer. Oh, man. You talk about middle class. No, you talk about working class. That was a working class beer.
Everyone right. Just looks happy. I mean, I didn't know that class came into it. It just looks happy.
And look at the guy with the gun rack in the background.
Yeah?
Those were the days. You finished your 8 hours at the factory, went to the bar, had a glass of Blatt's with the boys, went on home to your wife, had some frickin' pot roast. Man, that was it.
Okay. And then this one. I mean, that's just lovely.
Let's see what we got here. Old Taylor 86. Oh, man, that's a frickin' Norman Rockwell painting right there, isn't it? By the way, one of the things this brings up is the cars in the background. And someday I would love to do a British car retrospective show with you.
I thought you were going to say a road trip with me.
Well, I'd love to do that too.
A road trip. I think a road trip with you, I think that would be so much fun.
Let me tell you something. You show up near me, we will do a road trip out to Las Vegas or out to California. Oh, man, that'll be good. But British cars like the freaking Morris Minor or the Ford Cortina. Whatever happened to the British car?
You'd need to ask someone who knows about cars, which is all of my family except for me. They're all into cars. They all know about this stuff. But I'm afraid I just can't tell you. I'm sorry. But, in terms of the economics and the politics, it's just fucking post-World War II British decline. It's the unions being led by commies. It's the government making incompetent decisions and going for globalization. It's the big companies basically being just cuntish, but also really hamstrung by the unions. It's the working class losing a sense of patriotism and being part of something.
Thin Red Line says American cars of the 50s and 60s were awesome looking. Well, yeah, but everyone's cars of the 50s and 60s were awesome looking. British cars of the 50s and 60s were awesome looking. French cars of the 50s and 60s were awesome looking. Italian cars of the 50s and 60s were awesome looking. Russian cars of the 50s and 60s. Check out the design of something like a Zill limousine. Absolutely beautiful. Do Route 66 Millennial was East Coast to West, maybe a trip to Area 51 on the way. So without giving out too much of where I am, if you showed up in
You're not either, living in Area 51, are you?
No, no, no. If you showed up in either Atlanta, Washington, D.C., or Nashville, it'd be close enough for me to come and get you, and we'd go on a road trip.
Well, you know, I suspect I'm banned from America.
I'd love to visit again.
I really would, because I think it was kind of like my original idea was to go for 3 months. I ended up going for just over 1 month. I think it was like a month and a week. And then the whole doxing thing started while I was still there. So it was, I'm not going to go into that now, but it was too. The trip was too short, but at the same time, I'm not a good traveler. I'm not a natural traveler, so I was starting to get weary. Like by the time I got to Seattle, and that was only about 10 days into it. I don't know. I honestly don't know if I'd. I think I would have been able to handle 3 months because you just adapt. You just adapt to a different way of being. That's what happens. So I wish I'd done it for 3 months, and probably it would have been feasible. Probably it would have. You know, I could have done the flyover states, so called, and maybe even Texas. I'm sure I could have done it, but
just make the schedule, dude. We'll do it. I'll let you know when I'm off.
I know, as I say, I think that nowadays I wouldn't be allowed in.
I'm sure you would be. Don't worry about it. The authorities are not that competent. They're looking for Michael Savage, not for you.
Well, it's one of those things that makes you wish you were more obscure, you know? But I don't think so. I mean, other similar types have been, you know, turned away at the border. Deported at the airport. So I think it would happen to me as well. But, the only way to find out is to actually just try it. I don't think you can find out in advance. So, you know, I remember I think it was at the start of 2018, I did actually buy a ticket because I found one for like 80. It was some ridiculous price, really, really low price. And I was going to try just to find out whether I was banned. And then something else came up and I couldn't do it. I couldn't take the flight. So, but anyway, that's kind of irrelevant now because that's 5 years ago. Everything's changed again since then. So I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. it's an unknown quantity. But I would love to revisit and kind of do it better. But of course, everything's changed. You know, I'm not on YouTube now. There isn't the alt-right anymore. There isn't that whole sense of a global, international movement, let's say. Or at least not with the same sort of vigor as was going on then. But I suspect I could, if I did get in, I think certainly something would be possible.
Now, I just sent you a video, which is a YouTuber just did a video on the most redneck place in America. And without doxing myself too much, let me say the town that it was filmed in, it's 11:23 p.m. right now, And if I really wanted to, I could be in it before midnight. So I'm not too far away. But yeah, they could.
Do you want me to
show you that?
Do you want me to post this in the chat, in the live chat?
Sure, sure.
Oh, okay. Here we go. This is quite close to anti-dem. So let's see. Wait there a second. I've got bloody YouTube advert. Right. Oh, I see. Right.
You know exactly. So someone in chat says, you know exactly where I am. Well, you know, someplace very close to that. And yeah. But, you know, I it's exactly where I need to be.
Right. Well, here's just one more slice of Americana that I'll show you. I've had it stored up. Here it is. So for a lot of us outside of America, when we discover something like this, like we've never heard of this chain, but perhaps you have.
Oh, that was gone long before my time. There are chains I remember, like Kenny Rogers Chicken, Roland Roaster, Roy Rogers. There's plenty of them. But yeah, there's a little piece of Americana.
Yeah, isn't it lovely?
It's a totally different paradigm from Europe. Europe, when I was in Dublin, I went to a pub that has been in business constantly for 800 years.
Yeah.
And that's just amazing to contemplate. In California, building from the 1930s is considered old.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, it's just totally different here.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. America does have its own history, though, and even this kind of thing, because this is obviously not current. This is obviously a previous era, and it's endearing. I think all of these photos I've shown you, and here's another one. This is a postcard of I've forgotten the illustrator. It's a guy. I think his name is Howard Fogg. Can't remember, but he used to go around these for some reason. It must have been his job to draw, paint these lovely paintings of industrial plants and factories and stuff. So, isn't that just adorable, really? I love the color. I love how clear the water looks there. It's lovely.
Well, you know, pictures of a certain era in Britain sort of cause that same nostalgia for someplace I've never been, you know, especially through my grandmother. There's that Beatles movie, Help, from 1965, where the Beatles live in one of these beautiful, you know, distinctly British brick row houses. You know, the ones with the chimneys and the, you know, oh my gosh, that is so, so Britain to me.
This sort of thing, this is actually from Liverpool in 1965.
Look at those. Every Englishman a king of his castle. You know, this looks humble, but listen to me. This is why communism never took hold in Britain. Karl Marx figured that Britain and Germany would be the first countries where communism took hold, but they never did. And the reason they never did is because the British worker had enough. He had enough for himself. He had this little row house to call his own, to call his kingdom, to call his castle. He had a hot meal every night. He had a wife who did his laundry. He had a pub to go with his friends. This was enough for the working man. He didn't require a treasure. He didn't require riches. This was all he wanted. And as long as society was able to give it to him, the working man was happy. So, you know, well, I guess yes, that went by.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I mean, everything's changed. You know, they were moved from these houses into tower blocks, brutalist stuff. And then the demographic stuff happened.
There's a scene in Help where they go to an Indian restaurant in London and they figure out that all the employees are white Brits because they couldn't find enough Indians to staff a single restaurant in London. Think about that.
I mean, London, what's happened in London is, and I've never been to Birmingham, but I'm sure it's just as bad there.
Birmingham, Manchester, all the same.
You see it most viscerally when it's school kids, because I know from my own experience what school should look like, what a class of kids should look like, what a playground should look like. Not that I don't spend much time looking at playgrounds, just to be clear. But when you see a bunch of school kids in London and they're all, I mean, it's, you know, it's just, it hits you right in the feels, to say the least. Because that's a definite thing. You can see, as I say, you know how a bunch of school kids should look like, it's in your head. And it's just not how a bunch of British school kids should look. Just no longer marries up with the image in your head. And so similar things like that. It's when there's an archetype of it in your head and the reality no longer marries up with it that you realize, oh, shit. You know, that this really is changing. But with, as I say, with London, it's just unbelievable. But when I see photos of London from the past, because it's very easy to not believe that London was once white. It's very easy to think it must have always been like this. It must have always been at least a bit diverse, because just look at it now. But when you see photos from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and even the 60s, you realize, no, it actually was entirely white city.
Yep.
Up until the 60s. I mean, when you see photos in the 60s, you start seeing the odd black person. But prior to that, virtually 100% white. And so all of the stuff that we're told now, and this is what's, I mean, it's, but the replacement's bad enough. The altering of history is, well, it's Orwellian. And we're now told, oh, it was always diverse, it was always like this, always multiculturalism, nation of immigrants, black Romans, and all this fucking shite.
Yeah, Isaac Newton was black.
But the photographic evidence exists in copious quantities to disprove that claim.
Yeah.
Sorry, Isaac Newton. Oh, that's about the Doctor Who. Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, by the way, another TV show, if you haven't seen it yet, Life on Mars.
Oh, yes, I still haven't seen that.
Which takes you back to Manchester in the 70s.
Yeah. Well, dare I ask, what did you think of the sequel series?
Ashes to Ashes, it was all right. Wasn't as good as the original, though.
All right, okay.
Life on Mars is just an incredible classic.
Right.
I remember watching an interview with one of the guys who played one of the detectives in it, and he said that he actually went so far as to get the same aftershave that his dad used back when he was a kid and use it when he was on the set so that he not only looked like he was from the 70s, he smelled like he was from the 70s. But, oh, man, what a brilliant TV show.
I can't comment because I haven't seen it, I'm afraid.
Oh, you should. It's so good. So good.
I can hear the affection in your voice. You know, that's how I feel about Upstairs, Downstairs, for example. I can't talk about it without just feeling so much love for it. I'm going to be watching that in January. Have you ever seen Upstairs, Downstairs?
Way back in the day with my grandma.
Right, right. I wondered. Yeah, it's a different beast. Again, it's the multi-camera stuff that I love so much. And it's just adorable. But so well done. I mean, it's not just cute. It's so well done.
Well, you know, I've been saying for a while that we should study the idea of a differently based society, because we have this society based on the city, but there is an alternative to it, which is the manor-based, the country manor-based society.
Feudalism, you mean?
Yeah, sort of.
I mean, that word sounds bad, obviously, but it was a certain ideal.
It was a society of Britain. It was a society of Virginia when it first started. The idea of the, you know, many people say, like, well, okay, without the megacity, how will society progress? The manor-based society is an alternative model where you have the country squire who does things like sponsor great artists and great scientists, brings them into the manor, gives them a spare room someplace, gives them space to work. You know, this is one way that we can do things. And if you ever look at Brideshead Revisited, that's, by the way, I highly recommend the 1981 TV miniseries.
Of course.
Very true to the original book. Not the more recent movie from a few years ago. That's awful.
That was Ben Whishaw, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Ben Whishaw. And he was also in Cloud Atlas, which was terrible. Well, okay, let me refine that statement. Cloud Atlas was a good movie. It was a terrible political statement. There is another way to structure society. We can do it if we really want to. But, you know, so much of that heritage is lost and would have to be rebuilt. So many of those manor houses were torn down in Britain in the 20th century. We'd have to rebuild it all. But we can. We can.
That's true, we can. Well, let's leave it there. Because we've been going for 2.25 hours, which is longer than I was expecting.
Oh, there was a couple of other things I wanted to bring up.
Oh, okay then. All right, okay.
Well, first, did you see that the Secret Service wants to talk to John Schneider?
I don't know who John Schneider is.
He is the guy who played Bo Luke in the Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh!
he was on X, and apparently he said some things that the Secret Service thought were a little bit too threatening towards the president. So they want to go have a talk to him. So we are now officially so far in the clown world that the Secret Service is out looking to cuff and stuff them Duke boys.
Well, they did have the Confederate flag after all.
I've got the Confederate flag.
Listen to you, Fred posting.
literally over my bed is a Confederate flag and a flag with Kiryu and Satsuki from Kill la Kill. Because she is my waifu. Because she is full fash. So, come and get me.
Well, this kind of thing, it doesn't surprise me. I guess the only thing to say here is about the First Amendment. You know, if something like that can happen to this actor, I don't know. I certainly don't want to denigrate the First Amendment or America and so on. But it does seem like the First Amendment isn't worth as much as Americans thought it was. But what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it's worth as much as people will actually respect it. And when people start finding a way around it, you know, all I can say is that the saying that's starting to get some traction in America is that the second protects the first. So,
yes.
Make of that what you will.
So what did he say about the president? Was it?
He basically said he thought that Biden was a traitor and should receive the full legal punishment laid out in the Constitution for treason, which I'll leave you to guess what that is.
Right. Yes. Okay. Well, fair enough. I don't know. See, Biden just doesn't even seem capable of treason because he's senile.
Yeah, pretty much.
He just seems to do whatever they tell him to do.
Pretty much. Point.
And it has been like that all through his... I mean, this is what does surprise me about Biden. On the one hand, he seems senile. But on the other, he doesn't seem to be getting worse. Usually with dementia, it's pretty fast. And so I'm thinking, are they just pumping him full of the best drugs that they can possibly find to hold us at bay? Because it's been, what, 3 years now? I guess that is the answer. Well, what else did you want to bring up?
By the way, speaking of actually honoring people from the past, I don't know if you saw the story that they were digging a new strip mall in Virginia and came upon what was about 5 or 6 skeletons of what they, as best as they can tell, were British soldiers who were killed during the American Revolution. And in fact, they might actually have been from the Black Watch. And they repatriated them with full honors back to be buried in Scotland. And I just thought that was such a beautiful little touch of love and respect after all these years. Something so odd to see in these days when we're tearing down war monuments, and I'm glad they did that.
Yes, so am I. I think this is to do with the special relationship, if you like, but also just brotherhood of white people. But again, you know, the more that the demographics change in the U.S. government and so on, and indeed in the British equivalent, the less this kind of stuff is going to matter. I don't believe that Rishi Sunak really gives a shit about Remembrance Day, for example. I think he was just doing that as a sop to the British public. I mean, why else? Anyway, Anti-Dem, are you still there?
Oh, you hear me now?
Yes, yes, yes.
So what do you think of your new king?
Oh, gosh. No, I've got no faith in that at all. I think the Windsors are just done. They're irrelevant. They're not fit for purpose. The institutions, I wish we did have, I'm a monarchist, but I really think that, because people say, and I talked about this a year ago when Queen Elizabeth II died. People understandably say, well, what did she do for us? What did she do for Britain? What did she do to halt the decline, to combat it? And of course, the answer is there wasn't much she could do, because that's not her purpose. She's a symbol. But then, and conservatives tend to stop at that point. But I think, well, this just means that there shouldn't be a monarchy that's just a symbol, because it doesn't work. It's not what people want and expect and need from a monarch. They need the monarch to be more than a symbol. They need the monarch to actually have political power and to use it and to be unafraid of using it. And therefore, this whole thing needs to be overhauled. I mean, really, it needs to start again. I don't think you can overhaul something like this. It needs to be recreated from scratch. If the public are going to have these expectations, and they are, then the monarch and the constitutional arrangements surrounding the monarch should be such that the monarch can respond to those expectations. You know, if the public are going to expect the monarch to look after them, then arrangements should be such that the monarch can look after them, which means influencing law, influencing parliament, calling a state of emergency, and so forth, whatever. That's what I think. The issue with King Charles III is that, and this really goes for all powerful people, whether it's the heads of corporations, elected politicians, or a monarch, I wouldn't want him having power. Just as I wouldn't want Tony Blair having power. Just as I wouldn't want the head of Pfizer having power. Because the people who now get power are awful, and they're severely misinformed about things and about people and the public and nationhood. So they're treasonous and destructive. So I wouldn't want them having power. But again, this gets us back to the whole thing, which is that society needs to be recreated from the ground up. This society, you know, if you could salvage it, then fine, I would like to do that. But I think more likely it needs to all start all over again. So, you know, the aristocracy need to earn their place again. The monarch needs to earn his throne again. The whole thing needs to start as these things do start, which is not pleasant. But until that price is paid, we're going to be stuck with this sham, a very corrupt sham. So that's what I think about Charles III. Well, that's what I think about the monarchy and the Windsors. Charles III himself is, I mean, his head's in the clouds. He's a globalist stooge. So
being a monarchist doesn't mean supporting any one particular monarch. You know, I've had this just dispute with people, like telling them that being pro-white means that you want to save the white race. It doesn't mean that you necessarily want to save every single individual white person. There's a lot of people who don't want to be saved. There's a lot of people who can't be saved. You can't let traitors inside the gates. That's just suicide.
Yeah.
So you got to keep your eye on the totality, not the specific case. And same thing with monarchism. You can be a monarchist and say, this particular monarch needs to go. This particular dynasty needs to go and be replaced by somebody better.
Yeah, but as I agree, but as I say, the problem is not just the Windsors. I think it's the whole constitution, which limits the monarch's power, one way or another. So, because that just is what's happened. You know, I don't know the last time a monarch actually did anything in terms of politics, in terms of looking after the country. You know, it certainly hasn't been within my lifetime. To say the least.
Yeah.
So that whole thing needs to be overhauled. The elected politicians, if we are going to have democracy, then the elected politicians need to be scared shitless about what can happen to them from legally and above board from the monarch if they fuck around. And
which is why I think January 6th is the most glorious thing that's happened in America in ages, and we should not be running away from it.
Well,
you know, John Derbyshire said, you know, sometimes the elites need a couple of bricks through their windows to remind themselves to behave.
Obviously, we're not advocating anything here, just to be clear.
A couple of metaphorical bricks through their metaphorical windows.
Yeah.
But, you know, they do. And I think running away from that hasn't really benefited us at all. It shows us what our enemy is afraid of. And once we know what our enemy is afraid of, we have power over them.
That's true. That's true. You know, when Biden, someone else brought this up on Millennial, when Biden was inaugurated and the White House was surrounded by the military. I mean, it was amazing. It seemed to show an administration, an elite, that were terrified of the public, terrified of what the public might do to them.
What really makes that movie Civil War seem plausible? You know, where it would not have been in a previous time, but it is now.
Yeah. Well, I'm falling apart here, Auntie. I'm very tired. So,
all right, man.
Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up?
Did you see the last thing I posted on Gab?
Let me just check. I haven't. So I've been kind of dead on social media for the last couple of weeks with Millennial. Let me have a look. Hold on a second.
Well, you have a nice clicky keyboard.
Everyone says that. As far as I know, there's nothing unusual about it. I think it was £30. You know, it wasn't some bespoke, you know, device. It says the African who's stealing Sailor Moon's hairstyle.
Oh no, the one after that. The one after that.
We're so fucking far into, and then that's about the Duke of Hazzard. Optics matter a lot.
Yeah, optics matter a lot. That's the one I was talking about.
Okay, I'll put this up on screen for people. Hold on a second.
And that guy on the right, the guy with all the tats.
Hold on. Let me put this up first so that people can see what you're referring to. Right, there you go.
Yeah, he's one of Christopher Bolhouse's crew. Remember this. Remember that optics do matter. And people who say optics cuck, they're stupid because, yes, they are right in that we should not bend over backwards to try to appeal to our enemies. But that's not who we're trying to appeal to. Especially here in America. There's hundreds of millions of what you would call heritage American normie whites who can be brought to our side, who can be made to see things our way, and we cannot win without them. They are going to be the backbone of things. If there is a civil war, if there is a major disturbance, whatever we do in the future, and we have to appeal to them. We have to show them, you know, just like we were talking at the beginning of this show about guys like Nerdrotic, Geeks and Gamers, Critical Drinker, people who are behind where we are. But they were even more behind when where we were 5 years ago. They can be brought around. They can be made to see things our way. But we have to appeal to them the right way. And the bone face way is not the way to do it. They're never going to react to that. They're never going to react to 1488 Heil Hitler. They're never going to react to anything like that.
Well, who who the fuck reacts well to that guy? I would run a mile from that guy. I don't want anything
to
do. I'm sorry to be a snob or whatever, but fucking hell.
Absolutely. You know, this can't be what we do. This can't be how we present ourselves. We have to present ourselves in a way that the normies are going to get on board. Not all of them. I understand. We will never get all of them. We need enough of them. We need a tipping point of them to support us. And the image on the left is going to get them to do that. The image on the right is not going to get them to do that. So we have to be careful of who we are, what our message is, who our heroes are. Forget Hitler. You want to red pill the normie? Give him Henry Ford. Give him Charles Lindbergh. Those are American heroes that people will listen to. Give them the right imagery, and they will catch on. But we got to do this right. If we don't, if we just play into our enemies, then we're sunk. Again, if we can bring around a guy like Gary Beekler, who was a heroin addict, who spent 4 years in jail, who lived in San Francisco, and eventually came around to starting to see things at least a little bit our way, then we can do that. We can portray people. We can persuade people. But we got to do it the right way. So be careful of what you do. Be careful of how you present yourself. Be careful of the optics you send and the message that you send. Because you are in front of an audience. And if you do it the right way, you can get a lot of people on our side. And that's going to be absolutely critical in the years that come.
Yes, I certainly second that. I think people get carried away and they also think it's kind of ironic or clever to play up to certain stereotypes. And it just isn't. You're acting out, you're playing the role that your enemy has written for you. So don't do that. And think about what would appeal to you. Now, maybe if you're a young guy and you're full of testosterone and all that, then this guy would appeal to you, in which case just take my word for it. He will not appeal to most people. Now, I'm not saying that I would appeal to most people either. I'm an acquired taste, let's say. But the point is, we can do better than this. I mean, this kind of thing is just going to scare people off. So anyway, with that said, there are a couple of super chats, Anti-Dem, so I'll ask those to you now. Rogue Trader said, good to hear you're still around, Anti-Dem. Well, he's on Gab. You can always find him on Gab. Thanks for coming back on, you OG bastard. He said, you old bastard, and then he said, I mean OG. So
thank you. I am convinced that the old way of doing like 3,000 word Munchius mold bug essays is probably not the right way to go forth anymore. I am going to find that right way to go forth, and it's going to be more than Gab, but give me a little time to figure it out. I'll figure it out eventually.
Take a look at Substack. It might not work for you, but it's definitely worked for me. I find a whole new lease of life there. It's really good. But who knows? Something else might work better for you. But anyway, I wish you luck with whatever you do go in for. Darby says, is Auntie Dem a fan of Wanderer or The Zerper by U2? I think you answered this already.
Really, all of their work after Octum Baby. I mean, listen, Beautiful Day is a really catchy song. I like it. But other than that, everything they've done since Octum Baby is just not my thing.
Okay. I've remembered that I mentioned that cool 10-minute version of With or Without You, and I never actually put it up, so I'm going to do that now. Here it is in the private chat for you, Auntie Dem. And here it is for the audience. I mean, I don't really like you two, but they obviously had talent. It's obvious. It's undeniable. And I do like this song, along with New Year's Day. I think that's quite a good song. I'm sure there are others as well that I like. But I do love this song, and I particularly love this big extended version of it, which I don't think it's official. I think it was a fan-made remix. The other thing, of course, to say is that Bono, you know the song by Roy Orbison, Mystery Girl? She's a mystery to me. It was written by Bono.
Yeah.
Incredible.
GoldenEye, the Bond theme was written by Bono. Just Tina Turner performed it. So Alex DeLarge in the chat says, Auntie Dem, please get on Twitter. I'll follow you. I do actually have an X account. It's follow only. If I decide to start saying things there, I'll let you know.
Right. Okay, then. Okay, so there's no point in linking it below then. Okay then.
But I might decide to start using it in earnest. It's just at the moment it's just follow only.
I remember when you left Twitter. What was that, about 2019?
15.
No way.
Yeah, that long ago.
Holy shit. I hadn't started using it really. I mean, I had the account from 2014, but I barely used it really until 2017.
I actually had the account that I've got now is actually just the old account that I used to use to troll Ghost from True Capitalist Radio. But I reactivated it. It's there at the moment. It's just follow only, but I might, you know. Elon Twitter is a lot different thing, and I might decide to start saying things there, so we'll see. Has just been amazing.
It is a lot better than it was. There's no, just no question. Of course everyone's got complaints about it, but it's obviously a lot better than it used to be a year
ago. Elon, you talk about a gateway drug. You know, someone who is not where we are yet, but is starting to get there. Yeah, that's Elon. And boy, oh boy, are we lucky to have him.
Yeah, I do agree. Alex DeLarge in the chat is saying he doesn't like Gab because he says it's a ghetto. We don't want a platform inhabited only by conservatives, MAGA, and dissidents. We need to speak in the public square, and that's Twitter. The elite are on Twitter. Journalists are on Twitter. Everyone important is on Twitter. And I agree with Alex DeLarge there. And he also says, yes, it's possible to get by on Twitter and it's worth the trade-off in terms of not, you know, hiding your power level, so to speak. I completely, he also says it's improved massively. Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying there, Alex. So, Auntie Dem, can you think of a pithy quote from A Clockwork Orange?
Orange?
Oh, no. You've gone robot-y again.
hold on.
Fucking hell. Sounds like Johnny Five isn't quite alive. You might want to reconnect. Okay, we'll wait for him to come back and then we'll wrap it up. Just a few more, like probably a minute, everyone. Actually, if you do have any super chats, any questions for Antidem, you could post them now and we'll answer them. But otherwise, we'll close this one off imminently.
I'm back.
Okay, hello, hello, welcome back. So any pithy quote from A Clockwork Orange?
Clockwork Orange, I don't even really like that movie.
Neither do I, actually, but... The guy we're replying to is using the name from the main character.
Though I will say that if you're ever trying to get through the works of James Joyce, Anthony Burgess wrote A Guide to Getting Through Joyce, which is mostly sold under the name Rejoice. And if you absolutely do not get what you're getting through, when you're trying to read Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake, buy that book. It'll help. It'll get you through.
All right.
But I will say Kubrick, I much prefer Barry Lyndon over Clockwork Orange.
I've only seen Barry Lyndon once. And it oddly links with Napoleon because... You know about this, right? Barry Lyndon, a lot of it was apparently based on location research, maybe, I don't know, costume research that he did for the Napoleon film that he never made. Do you know about this?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a weird thing. And of course, the thing that everyone always says about that film is the fancy lenses they used, NASA lenses that they used so that they could film in candlelight. It's amazing to think about it.
Now, where was that place that Clockwork Orange filmed? The place they've torn down now?
Yeah, Thamesmead.
Thamesmead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I fucking wish. One of my big regrets is that I never visited it. And I could have literally walked along the lake. Gone up the steps and into the shopping area and then gone to the residential parts. I could have seen it all. I could have walked through the whole thing. And now it's gone. Well, the lake's still there, but, you know, that's it.
They also filmed Misfits there.
Yeah, I've not seen that. But, yeah, I know it was filmed. There were a few things filmed there. Yeah. It's funny that whole, well, not funny, but it's notable that entire dream of the post-war, it's just all over, all completely over, about the brutalism, the welfare state, in a sense, the idea of that version of the private and public sector coexisting, but not really interacting. It's gone now. And the image of a class, slightly classless society is gone. It was off a period. But all of those concrete buildings, largely gone now.
Well, I have a feeling you and I could do an architecture show just on that.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I'm not well versed. I like architecture, but I'm not educated on it. But I do like, I love it actually, because places are so important, buildings are so important, the way they affect people. So you've got to be interested in architecture. If it's just part of sociology and psychology, but yeah, I've got loads. I've got a whole. I've got a huge folder of photos of, it goes from architecture, then into that subfolder brutalism, subfolder Thamesmead, and then that's divided down by year. You know, I really did learn a lot about Thamesmead. It was a sort of autistic obsession 10 years ago. and just as they were fucking demolishing it. So I've got many photos to choose from, but here's the one that's obviously iconic from the film. And this is really, in actual fact, not a lot of A Clockwork Orange was filmed in Thamesmead. Not nearly as much as people tend to think. But this bit obviously was. This is by the lake. There you go. But yeah, it was, I mean, here it is when it was first built. Hold on a second. So all of that's gone now. All of that that you see there, apart from the stuff in the immediate foreground.
It's so amazing that anyone ever looked at that and thought, here is a place where human beings will like to live.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Here's a place that will not bring out the worst in people. Exactly. But here it is when it was new. And as you can see, it's a sunny day. The kids are happy.
Yeah, but it still looks like a place where Darth Vader works.
Yeah. Have I ever shown you the comparison? I do this a lot. I make comparison images.
And didn't they actually film some amount of Andor in some of these British brutalist buildings?
Well, I think they did, but it wasn't Thamesmead because it was gone by then. Here's a comparison of the same location. I can't tell you. The first one will be 1967, but I think the second one is like 2007.
I'm shocked they got paint to stick to that concrete.
There you go. And there's another one. Yeah, here's another one. This is the play area. Again, right when it was new, and then in the, I think, the mid-2000s. There you go. So as you can see, the social club on the right there, the Pyramid Club it was called, is all boarded up. And the play stuff has been drastically simplified.
You know what this looks like? This looks like a place that you should have the Irish Troubles.
Yes. Well, Northern Ireland would have been full of this stuff as well.
Well, what was it? The Divis Flats in Belfast? That's exactly what they were.
Yeah. It was, I mean, this stuff really dominated Britain in the 60s and 70s and 80s. This is just what a lot of places look like.
I mean, this looks so much like a Morrissey video.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Morrissey grew up in the Victorian sort of Manchester
By the way, Morrissey, man, talk about somebody who got unexpectedly black-pilled, red-pilled. Talk about that guy, man. It's who would ever thought we'd have Moz on our side?
I know. But he's the kind of guy who matches a lot of the people in this movement in the sense that he's cantankerous and very obstinate, and so he's not afraid to fall out with everyone.
Yeah, if you make somebody an outsider their entire life, don't be surprised if they're, you know, not getting with your program.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, look, I'm very tired.
All right.
We're gonna have to call it a night, but it's been a very enjoyable conversation. I know that some people have said nice things in the chat about it.
I'll finally let you go to sleep.
Okay. All right. Yeah, well, I've enjoyed this. So
yeah, I have too.
Yeah, it's been nice. It's always very laid back with you.
Like I said, a nice little break from all the heaviness of some of the other guests.
Yeah.
And you're lucky that I never did that comedy bit, because I was going to do my Frenchman from Monty Python and the Holy Grail voice and poke a little fun at a certain someone in the dissident right who may or may not have murdered their wife and dumped her body in a Canadian pine forest. So,
well, let's hope not.
We're going to, yeah, just because of the cold, I couldn't do that. But
all right.
And I'm sure you're just as happy that I won't.
Yes, thank you. All right. Well, Auntie Dem, I will see you later. And it's been a pleasure as ever.
Let's not wait a whole year before we do this again.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. I'll be back tomorrow night. Let me see who's on tomorrow night. Okay. The Woodlander Homeland Institute. And then J.F. Gary A.P.
And then, I did not dump him at WEF in the Pan Fellest.
Yes, thank you.
It is a dirty slander.
Look, I don't think that happened, for fuck's sake. If I did, I wouldn't be having him on. But that's a whole other thing.
She went off to live the life of adventure among the Fairies and the Gnomes of the Forest.
For fuck's sake. All right. That aside, then finally Semiogog. So that's going to be quite a mix. Okay. I will see you all tomorrow. Auntie Dem, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Find the info at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.